Good morning. Lisa Gardner-Springer, are you there?
I am.
So there in Minneapolis, you received your stimulus check, right?
I did.
And I guess because your income is kind of high, the check wasn't so big, right?
It was $1.
$1?
Yes.
So what's a dollar's worth of stimulus amount to in this $13 trillion economy, Lisa?
A trip to Target, where we bought our five-year-old daughter her birthday party tiara.
There you have it. Microeconomics, keeping the U.S. economy afloat with little girl baubles and plastic tiaras. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 9th. A micro and macro view of some new economic statistics. Unemployment is at 5.5%. Who's getting hit? Also, China's media returning to the bunker after an opening to the world. A monster sports weekend. The Celtics have a 2-0 lead. Your movie reviews and a serious look at where your stimulus checks are going. That and all the news. Severe weather is to blame in at least 8 deaths over the weekend in the Midwest and New England. And more rain is likely today in Indiana, where hundreds of residents are already flooded out of their homes. In Nebraska, the National Weather Service has confirmed a tornado touched down in southwest Omaha yesterday morning. Jill Yeppert was in bed when it hit.
I was thanking the Almighty that our bedroom window didn't break, because otherwise we would have been probably all bloody.
The twister damaged several dozen homes and businesses, but no fatalities were reported. Another strong aftershock has rattled cities in central China. The U.S. Geological Survey puts it at magnitude 5. This comes as the Chinese military continues to try to drain a quake-formed lake that threatens to flood downstream villages.
As the race to replace him dominates attention at home, President Bush is off to Europe to rally support from allies. At a summit in Slovenia, Bush will push for stronger penalties against Iran to discourage it from developing nuclear weapons. American troops are coming under heavy fire during a raid in northwestern Iraq. It called in airstrikes today. The military says 5 suspected al-Qaeda in Iraq militants were killed. A parked car packed with explosives detonated near a passing Iraqi army patrol in eastern Baghdad. It killed 3 civilians and an army lieutenant.
In Texas, fire investigators say arson's to blame for a fire that damaged the historic governor's mansion. They're asking for the public's help in identifying who may be to blame. Governor Rick Perry and his wife haven't been living there while the mansion gets a $10 million renovation.
In Tokyo, a man stabbed 7 people to death and injured at least a dozen more yesterday. Witnesses say the attacker drove into a crowd in the city's electronics district. High gas and oil prices. The oil prices dropped overnight, but Asian markets are choppy today after the serious fall off on Wall Street over the weekend. So with all that economic news, we're talking about stimulus checks.
And are they helping?
And
how
where are they
spending,
going?
How are you spending your stimulus check?
Tell us a story. How are you spending your stimulus check? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
All kinds of ways we've learned,
well,
and we will learn.
Stimulus checks are big and small, as we learned, everything from a dollar up to several $100s, and people have all kinds of ways of spending them. And it turns out you don't get a stimulus check if your income is too high or too low. Stimulus. Stimulate us.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. We learned on Friday that unemployment rate hit 5.5%. It was the biggest jump in 2 decades and also a high rate of unemployment by any measure. Also, the price of oil, the price of gasoline, rather, over the last 3 weeks is now at $4 a barrel. That's the average price of a gallon of gasoline, unleaded regular gasoline. In most places, it's well above $4. The euro is surging. The dollar is declining. We wanted to get behind some of these numbers and see what's going on with the economy, industry by industry, sector by sector. Joining us now is Sophia Koropetsky, who's an economist for Moody'sEconomy.com. Sophia, thanks for joining us. And let's look at unemployment first. How do we take the 5.5% unemployment rate apart and see what it means industry by industry?
There are a few interesting aspects to this increase in the unemployment rate, but one should first understand that data are squirrely, and we're not seeing a huge jump in the last month, but the rate of 5.5% is probably what it should be, and last month's rate was probably too low somehow. So I'd just like to get that out first.
Sure.
I'm seeing is that the people who are being hurt are those who are less educated primarily. College-educated people are still doing pretty well, and the demand for college-educated people is still pretty good. I mean, we're hiring where I work, and I think that's an important point because with prices rising, less educated people who usually have lower incomes, they're the ones that are being squeezed the most. And then that leads me to the second point, is that what we've seen in the past few months is that the labor force participation rate, that means the share of people who are, between 25 and 44, women between 25 and 44 has shot up recently.
So that's the percentage of the population that's actually a part of the labor force, right?
That's right. That's exactly it.
Yep.
So the share of those women has shot up recently. And this follows a number of years and all sorts of articles about how fewer women are in the labor force. And I think this recent increase reflects the fact that households are being squeezed. You know, they're no longer be able to extract from home equity to finance spending. Wages aren't rising and costs are rising. In fact, you know, real wages are falling. So that's an interesting aspect of what's been going on.
And Sophia, is there going to be a way to track that over a period of time to really test that hypothesis to see if that is indeed the reason why you're seeing more women? Is that because the families are really struggling?
Yeah, I'm making certain assumptions, admittedly, but we are sort of seeing a confluence of events going on here, and it does seem from the evidence that more women were able to stay at home because of higher house prices in recent years, and that they could tap into that home equity, which isn't there anymore.
Well, these are potentially transformative changes. I mean, the 70s and 80s, during the recession, in the prolonged recession in the 1970s and early 80s, a lot of homes went from single income to multiple income, double income households.
Right.
And that transformed the American economy. These kinds of changes are the ones that really flip things around.
Well, and then actually, it's tied to that is the fact that household incomes have really been increasing in recent decades because of the entry of women into the workforce. Otherwise, wages haven't been rising much at all, corrected for inflation. So if inflation is, and other things are putting a squeeze on households, we're seeing a little bit of a bump up now. In terms of, I mean, we need a few more months of data, though, to see whether there's really a trend here.
And one place they're really feeling the squeeze is in Georgia. The number of people getting unemployment insurance benefits, according to the government there, is up 51% from just a year ago. Charlie Fleming is the president of the North Georgia Labor Council in Atlanta, where Ford and GM are both closing factories. Good morning, Charlie.
Good morning.
GM says it's shopping about 4,700 jobs in the fall. What are people that you talk to, what are they most worried about?
Well, providing for their families, first of all. But as you mentioned, we're losing both a Ford and a GM plant AT&T has just announced some layoffs. The city of Atlanta has just laid off 425 workers. So there's certainly a downturn in the economy and in the job market. And many of these jobs, which were good industrial-type jobs that paid good wages, folks are now having to go to either a service-oriented job or a retail job where, of course, the pay isn't quite so well.
Charlie, are you seeing families making choices like, you know, both heads of the both members of the household working, people taking jobs, one and two jobs to make ends meet, sort of what Sophia was talking about a moment ago, that maybe women who weren't in the workforce are entering the workforce to try to tide over some families?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a great point. I think that trend's been happening not just since this recent downturn, but for a number of years now. The dollar isn't as good as, I mean, I look back at my industry, which is an airline. I worked in the airline industry for 30 years. Wages have been stagnant for well over 10 years. And, you know, with the global economy and all these free trade agreements, we've been talking about the automobile industry. Well, I also just saw where GM in Mexico just started their first two-tiered pay scale. So now if you're a Mexican worker building a GM product, you now start off at $4.50 an hour instead of the $8.50 an hour that folks were making. And you compare that to what the folks make here in the States. You know, I question those trade agreements, I guess is my point, because instead of rising or raising the level for the global economy, it seems like we're going downward towards some of these other countries.
Well, it's interesting, Charlie. You're talking about downward pressure on wages even in outsourced facilities like in Mexico there at GM. Generally speaking, Sophia, is there downward pressure on wages all across the economy?
In the U.S. economy?
Sure.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, and certainly in industries that are heavily unionized. The auto industry, there's so many instances of suppliers taking pay cuts. Well, the most recent example is the outcome of the American Axle strike, that workers agreed to that, and you know, they cut plenty of jobs after that anyway. I thought you were going to ask me about in other parts of the world. In China, there is downward pressure on wages, and because of competitive forces there.
And Sophia, isn't there a second layer to this? We've read some stories that say people are raiding their 401ks to pay mortgages. So then what does that do to the underlying security, economic security of families?
Obviously it can't be good because, the government may or may not be able to step in to help out people. Oh, and actually that's another point, too, that if the economy continues to deteriorate, particularly if the labor market situation continues to deteriorate, it's likely, that a second stimulus package will be proposed.
And will be necessary. Charlie, I suspect you're all over people making themselves less secure by spending 401ks and other sort of retirement vehicles, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, we, of course, in the labor movement have always fought for defined benefit retirement plans so people could actually plan on those retirements. Depending on where you are in the cycle, if you're getting close to retirement and you're starting to feel these outside pressures and you have to go into your retirement savings through your 401, I mean, that could be devastating for a family.
Devastating, or at the very least, undefined benefits. That's for sure. That's what we're all looking at. Charlie Fleming, thank you very much for joining us. Airline mechanic and president of the North Georgia Labor Council, the AFL-CIO. And Sophia Koropetsky, an economist for MoodysEconomy.com. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
You know, both of these individuals don't see any sign of stabilization either in the labor market or in downward pressure on wages until the end of the year.
And that's what makes it extraordinarily stressful, because these timelines keep getting shifted. We keep hearing that perhaps the market's getting better, or and then we hear it's not, and then we see
fuel prices.
Yeah, we
spiking.
See oil prices hit 139. It's an evolving story for sure. We'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. 2008, of course, is a political year here in the United States, but it's a landmark year for the nation of China. When it was announced that China would host the Olympics, certainly everyone expected that a window would open on that society. Well, a window did open. It's been far more detailed than any outside of China perhaps would have expected, and certainly far different than the people inside China would have expected, particularly the Chinese government. Joining us now is Brooke Gladstone from Public Radio's On the Media. Brooke has spent the past week in China. She's been reporting now from Hong Kong. She joins us from Hong Kong. Hello, Brooke. The state of Chinese media is our subject this morning, and I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of how people in China are thinking of themselves, given these two enormous waves of global attention in the Tibetan demonstrations and now the tragic earthquake.
Hello, John. Hello, Adora. I think people are feeling pretty good about themselves with regard to the kind of national coming together, the heroism that we saw in the wake of the earthquake. With regard to the Tibet issue, there's a lot of perplexity and no small amount of anger. They feel that the West is misinformed, they don't understand the Chinese position, and they're frankly confused why there seems to be a reflex to condemn China when China increasingly considers itself a partner on the global stage and wants to be accepted by nations.
Has there been a change in the way the Chinese media has been covering the earthquake? In the beginning, it seemed like an unprecedented opening to the entire world as media was allowed to cover virtually every aspect of that story. Indeed, public radio listeners were witness to some amazing reporting by our colleagues at NPR. But as recently as last week, we had pictures of parents outraged over the construction of schools being pulled away from cameras in demonstrations that appeared to be motivating some kind of a crackdown. What have you observed?
Well, the thing is that the Chinese media just are not free. What you saw at the beginning was partly a response to an ordinance that was passed on May 1st regarding rules about coverage, which were calling for more openness, particularly in the event of disasters, but across a whole variety of issues. But it was easy to allow open coverage then because the storyline was very positive, very comfortable. You know, it was about heroes. It was about tragedy. It was about public support, global sympathy. I mean, a disaster is not a hard thing to cover once you get around the fact that something bad has happened to your nation and the rest of the world is going to know, because there is no one to blame. You can't blame anyone for an earthquake. You can blame people for shoddy school construction. That created a bit of a conundrum within the Chinese propaganda ministries. And yeah, they made some attempt to pull those people away. That was a story that everybody saw, but the fact is everybody saw it. And there still is reporting on the shoddy schools, even though there are quiet whispers, could you cool it, could you cool it? But the fact of the matter is a ban is not, is a ban in China. You get around it, you find kind of sideways to deal with it, and the stories can get out. There was something actually remarkable that happened last week, which sort of really points this out, this sort of weird ambiguity about whether or not the media are free here or not. And I don't know, do we have time for a quick story?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, well, there is, you know, they say that there are several things you can never mention in Chinese media. They're called the three T's and the F, Taiwan, Tibet, Tiananmen, and Falun Gong, the religion. Now, for 19 years, there has been a commemoration of Tiananmen Square in Hong Kong. It has never been reported in mainland China. Last week on the China-controlled CCTV website, it was the sports website, there was a picture for the first time of that demonstration, and it was called a moonlight vigil for the victims of the Sichuan earthquake. Now, that may seem a little strange and indirect, but everybody knew what it was, and it disappeared very soon after that. They talked about the martyrs and the mourning. They just didn't specify what sort of martyrs they were, but it was.
And it had nothing to do with the earthquake, right?
Absolutely nothing to do with it, and everybody knew.
Covering the Chinese media this week, Brooke Gladstone is the host of On the Media by WNYC and NPR. She was in Hong Kong.
And we're asking people today about their stimulus checks. Have you gotten one, and what are you spending it on? And we heard from Ann Heisler. I'll be putting my stimulus check of $600 into my savings account, she writes. The office I work with is being downsized at the end of the month, and I'll be out of a job. Stimulate that, George Bush.
Although savings is actually a form of stimulus, it just helps in the amount of money that's available for lending. I received a $600 stimulus payment, says P. Peterson. I used it to pay a $578 Cobra for health insurance plus $48 in dental. Total $626. I suppose I'm helping keeping those big insurance companies that keep our big politicians afloat. Thanks for the stimulus there, Pete.
Thank you. We want to hear your story. 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And now for the latest headlines from Femi Okay. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there, Adora. 27 minutes past the hour. This morning we've had another very strong aftershock rattling the cities in central China. President Bush has declared that some Indiana counties are disaster areas after days of flooding rains. And President Bush is off to Europe this morning to rally support from his allies. The first stop will be a summit with the European Union leaders in Slovenia. It has been a very rough weekend as far as the weather's concerned, with extreme heat in the east and disastrous rain in Indiana, storms also hitting Wisconsin and Iowa. Bruce Terry is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Bruce, where can we expect to see the severe weather today across the nation?
Pretty much the same areas we saw over the weekend. We still have a very significant threat of severe weather and flooding all the way from the lower Great Lakes, south-southwestward into the southern plains. In some cases, we'll be looking at rainfall amounts in parts of Kansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Arkansas of 3 to 5 inches by tomorrow morning. And again, there'll be the threat of severe weather all the way into the lower Great Lakes.
And of course, the other big story from this weekend was the extreme heat along the East Coast. How will people along the East Coast be faring today?
Pretty much the same again here also. We have at least two more days of very hot temperatures over the eastern U.S., high temperatures both today and tomorrow will be well into the 90s, with some areas reaching 100 degrees, and that'll push the heat in the season to the low 100s, anywhere between 100 and 110 degrees. But by Wednesday, we'll see relief in the east.
Of course, Bruce, when you see scenes like we saw over the weekend in Indiana, you ask yourself, you know, is this record-breaking amount of flooding? Is it?
No, it's not. I'm sure people out there are suffering, but we have a battle zone between the real hot weather in the east and the unseasonably cold weather in the west, and that's where we're beginning the heavy rains. But I think even at this point, we're not anywhere close to what we saw back there in 1993, where we had week after week and even month after month of heavy rain in that area.
Bruce Terry from the National Weather Service, thank you for doing our forecast for us on The Takeaway this morning.
You're welcome.
All right, take care. So the severe weather in the Midwest and Connecticut has been blamed for at least 8 deaths. Also, hundreds of Indiana residents have spent the night out of their homes. It's going to take a little while for that flood water to go down. Still expecting, as Bruce said, more rain today. And now the governors of Wisconsin and Iowa are also asking for federal help because of their weekend floods. So this story isn't over quite yet.
Floods in the Midwest, heat in the east. You're the only one dressed for this weather, Femi.
And I have my umbrella with me.
Yes, good for
you. I'm British.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, now featuring Mandy and Lester, a short film about a girl who loses 2 boxes of Scout cookies, a boy who finds those cookies, and who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems. Available at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 9th, and boy, there was a whole lot of sports action over the weekend, and we're going to try to get you up to speed on that. This morning, as you know, John, the Celtics will wake up with another win.
Ouch. 2-0.
And it's likely the NBA is going to be quite happy about that. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, the passing of famed sportscaster Jim McKay. For 40 years, he was the face and voice of ABC's Wide World of Sports. And for decades, he took Americans through 12 Olympics, including the 1972 Summer Games in Munich, where Palestinian terrorists kidnapped 11 Israeli athletes. Here's McKay covering that.
There were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. 9 were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone. The Israeli Olympic team was destroyed, much of it. Some of their officials.
That was Jim McKay in 1972. David Zirin is the author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. He's joining us. Good morning, David.
Hey, great to be here, guys. Thank you.
What's Jim McKay's legacy, you think?
Jim McKay's legacy is that sports journalism can rise to the occasion to actually be journalism and not merely exist in the world of sports. It's interesting that a lot of people attribute that idea that sports journalism can transcend sports to people like Howard Cosell because of his association with Muhammad Ali in the 1960s. But if you really look at the sort of journalist who could rise to the occasion on the TV medium, it really is. It begins with Jim McKay, and people like Bob Costas, Bryant Gumbel, I mean, they really owe their careers, the kind of sports careers that they've been able to carve for themselves, to Jim McKay.
But even given that, though, it seems, Dave, that McKay is in a class by himself. I mean, he really had that anchor voice, that hold still, history is happening before our eyes here kind of ability to transcend news and sports. I mean, when he was anchoring those broadcasts from the 72 Olympics, Munich Olympics, there was no question that you would stay with the sports guy.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I mean, like he laid the foundation. Yep. And it's interesting, like, who his producer was back in those days was Rune Arledge,
yes.
Who later became an absolute pioneer, of course, in just mainstream TV news broadcasting and production. And it really,
you know,
part of the team and the groundwork that changed TV news forever.
And part of McKay's legacy is that his son is running CBS.
Yep, McManus.
Sean McManus.
And I think that should really say something. But Jim McKay, an absolute class act, the kind of person who would never overwhelm the story, but who could illuminate the story, and a person who I think is an unsung hero for people who want to see sports journalism be something that transcends mere sports and actually speaks to the real world, you know, that pesky real world that the sports world inhabits.
Well, we've got
And Sean McManus, we should just say, is not only the head of CBS News, but he's also the head of CBS Sports. We sort of merged what his father was involved with and what Rune Arledge was involved in. Also this weekend, the racehorse at Belmont, Big Brown, not only didn't win, David,
right,
he came in last. What happened?
Well, this is grabbing, actually looking forward to talking to you guys about this. Because, as you know, I've written a lot about issues of steroids in Major League Baseball. Yet there's far less discussion about steroids in horse racing. But before we go there to the big, bad, anabolic world in horse racing, we should keep in mind that this should remind us how difficult it is to win the Triple Crown in horse racing. It's one of the most difficult things in sports. It's only happened 11 times in history. It hasn't happened in 30 years since affirmed in 1978. And yet in this case in particular, I mean, if you look at Big Brown, I mean, this is someone who, like a lot of these horses in these big races, took steroids. It's on something called Winstrol. And it's interesting. There are 3 states where it's legal to take steroids. I'm not going to ask you on the air to guess what 3 states those are. I'll just tell you here. But those 3 states are New York, Maryland, and Kentucky, the 3 states where the Triple Crown is.
Right, there you go.
Da-da-ding! You know, and this is the deal with what happened to this deal was that Big Brown, the trainer, who's a bit of a, let's just call him eccentric here, he was telling the world, he said, well, my horse doesn't need Winstrol. We're going to get rid of his cycle for last month. He doesn't need his cycle. He can do it all by himself. And then now they're wondering, did he have a crack in his hoof? Gee, was he just not in the mood to race the other day? And I think what you're going to see in the next year, a year from now, maybe 2 years, but you're going to see steroids completely banned from horse racing, because what it ends up doing, actually, it's incredibly cruel to the horse. And it's interesting how when it exposes itself isn't a race like Belmont. It's by far, you know, it's over a mile long. It's an incredibly grueling race for a horse, especially a three-year-old. Horses aren't even up to maturity, for goodness sake.
And, David, we're probably going to find out a little bit more about exactly what unfolded for Big Brown. Just want to note really quickly a surprise at the French Open. Spain's Rafael Nadal whipped the Swiss Roger Federer, cleaning up 6-1, 6-3, and 6-0. We only have a few minutes. The Lakers and the Celtics. The Celtics are two games ahead, right?
As someone who was born and raised in New York City, I mean, this is so painful for me to see. But just I want to say something to the Lakers-Celtics here. This is the biggest opportunity for the NBA to reclaim an audience of people over 35. Because, I mean, there is a huge nostalgia factor. Because with the Lakers, you have the Hillary Clinton of the NBA and Kobe Bryant. Everybody has an opinion about Kobe. You either love him or you hate him. He is Hillary Clinton. And just like Hillary Clinton, everybody loves him. They tune in to see Hillary. They'll tune in to see Kobe. And this is the hottest ticket in sports.
Thank you, David Zirin, the hottest ticket, he says. Writer for SportsIllustrator.com and also an author. We'll be hearing from him again soon, but right now we're going to hear from Femi Okeh with the latest headlines. Femi?
Hello there. 21 minutes to the hour. President Bush is on his way to Europe this morning. Spanish truckers are on strike to protest high gas prices, and gas prices have hit a new high here in the United States, an average of $4 a gallon. A military defense lawyer at Guantanamo Bay says the Pentagon instructed interrogators at the facility to destroy handwritten notes in case they were called to testify about the treatment of detainees. The lawyer says that the instructions could help terrorism suspects defend themselves at trial. The state fire marshal's office in Texas says it's looking for an arsonist after a fire swept through the Texas governor's mansion early yesterday and caused extensive damage. The mansion has been unoccupied for months while it undergoes $10 million worth of renovations. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez is calling on the Colombian rebel group FARC to end its campaign and release hundreds of hostages. The Colombian government says it welcomed the call. In the past, Colombia has accused Venezuela of funding the rebels. And finally, six people were tossed into the Gulf of Mexico when their boat capsized during a regatta on Saturday. Five of them survived 26 hours in the sea, but safety officer Roger Stone died as he helped to save others. He's been called a hero as he pulled two sailors from below decks as the boat went under. Coast Guard spokesperson Renny Aiello described the search for Stone.
We worked feverishly around the clock in an attempt to locate the sixth boater. We've exhausted all of our search efforts and we utilized everything, all of our assets available to us in this search and rescue case.
And that was Safety Officer Richard Stone, who died in an attempt to save others.
Tragic story and a weird story in Texas. That governor's mansion, who would burn down the governor's mansion? Guess they'll need some more renovations. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
You have done well, Panda.
Done well? I've done awesome!
Oof. Yes, you have done awesome.
You have done well, Panda. Yes, the big movie over the weekend was Kung Fu Panda, which made $60 million at the box office. And as we like to do on this program, we review the movies by bringing you someone whose life represents the storyline of the movie, is very close to the storyline of the movie. And unfortunately, there were no talking pandas available for us to speak with. So we turned to the number two movie, which was You Don't Mess with the Zohan, the Adam Sandler movie. It was very big at the box office. It made $40 million. And it's about an Israeli hairdresser. And Oded Gabay, thanks for joining us. You're an Israeli hairdresser at the Lovella Hair Salon here in New York. What did you think of the movie?
First of all, thank you very much for inviting me.
Please. And our pleasure.
I really, really think that it's amazing story, and it's exactly my life story.
It's exactly
my life story. It's like somebody copied my life story and made it a little more extreme, and the movie is hilarious. It's so funny. And
your real life story, because we should add that Adam Sandler's character was an Israeli anti-terrorism commando who decided he wanted to become a hairstylist.
Settle down.
And move to New York. So he's a martial arts expert. He's a sharpshooter. He's all kinds of things, as well as someone who enjoys hairstyles.
Yes.
That's you?
That's exactly me.
So you know Kung Fu?
I used to compete in martial arts. I have a second degree black belt in Israel, judo, jiu-jitsu, and karate. And
how does that work for you, actually, in the salon?
Actually, it gives you confidence. My client, they never mess with me because they know that they'll be in trouble if they mess with me. So they all smile and they love it.
Are you surprised that this story came out now? There's a certain sensitivity about talking about Israeli characters and making fun of a subject that often appears in the news to be not very funny at all. Merging hairdressing and counterterrorism doesn't necessarily seem to be a merger that would work on the screen.
You know, I feel like you're going from the end to the beginning, but I have something to say regards that. I thought overall, with all the humor in the movie, I really thought that he had a really strong point, and it was amazing, with all the humor, that he brought the peace out, and he really put them together, the Arabs and the Jews and the Israelis together. And
so it was realistic.
Yeah, it really? Was...
You were in the army
yeah.
growing up, right? So
yeah.
So do all Israelis in the army have aspirations to be counterterrorists, or is the army something you just sort of do and hope that it's over soon?
Because it's required.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's... You kind of, as an Israeli, you live in a bubble in some way, and I had the chance to live outside of the country to see that you're... I came here to the country of opportunities, and I really feel like you could live together without any problems. By the minute that you get the politics involved, you might feel the same feeling that you had back there. But I have a person that worked with me. So
Adam Sandler is possibly a cultural ambassador.
Could be.
Odeka Bay, thank you very much for being with us. This is great.
From
hairdresser in New York,
yeah,
and reviewing the movie Don't Mess with the Zohan. Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good Monday morning. It is June 9th and time for the latest headlines from Femi Oke. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning. 12 minutes to the hour. Senator Edward Kennedy is expected to be released from the hospital a week after undergoing surgery in North Carolina for brain cancer. The news comes from his son, Patrick Kennedy. Midwest faces more rain. Indiana was already swamped by 10 inches of rain over the last few days. Floods have also hit Wisconsin and Iowa badly too. More rain expected in today's forecast and along the East Coast, though sizzling temperatures continue. Money is on the mind of the top presidential contenders today. Democrat Barack Obama gives a speech in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then travels on to St. Louis for a fundraiser. And Republican John McCain raises cash in Virginia and also Washington. And about 300 people turned out Sunday night in Crawford, Texas, for the premiere of a documentary film about how the lives in the tiny town were changed when the Bush family moved to Crawford in 1999. Now, if you haven't had a chance to see the movie yet, here's a clip.
You'll go in that little town, and there's one stoplight, and there's about three places where you can buy Bush souvenirs, and you go down four blocks and make a left, and there's six satellite trucks and national reporters, and they're all doing, they're doing the exact same shot.
You know what that shot is? It's where the reporter's standing up in front of the bushels of hay and the tractor doing their live shots for the television.
The Sheehan position.
Yes.
Yes.
705 people live in Texas. 300 turned up for the movie.
Where is St. Louis?
St. Louis.
Oh, okay. That's
it's in the same place as
Missouri.
Just behind
Missouri.
My... Yeah.
St. Louis, Missouri. Sorry about
in
that.
It's in Femiland.
That's cheap because yes. Dylan, our director, yes. Dylan, our director, said we should call you Femis.
Femis.
Right.
Femis.
The S. Get it? Okay.
I get it.
Moving on.
He's funny today, isn't he, Dylan? Hilarious.
Kind of a weird mood. You know,
my sides are just split. I must leave.
Thing, yeah.
We are talking about the economy today, about the jump in unemployment numbers, about the spiking oil prices, and
about an economy that needs some stimulus.
That needs some stimulus. And a ray of hope, according to the Bush administration, is the stimulus checks that are in the mail now to Americans. How will you spend that if you still haven't figured it out? How to keep that government bonus from burning a hole in your pocket? Well, Rudy Adler is with us right now. He is the founder of the website, howispentmystimulus.com. Rudy, you are here to guide us, and you already got your check. What'd you do with it?
Well, you know, I guess my check went into building this site. Basically, I built this site, howispentmystimulus.com. It allows people to log on, post a photo of what they purchased, and describe what they bought and why.
And you've had a tremendous reaction. You've gotten hundreds and hundreds of responses, so many that you've actually had to break them down into categories. Give us your categories and then give us a sample of what someone had to say.
Yeah, so right now the leading categories seem to be the mundane categories, things that focus on gas, food, and sort of debt, credit card purchases. And there's also a category called weird that we have on the site.
Weird. Okay. Give us an example.
So, you know, people that are spending money on bailing themselves out of jail, tattoos. Some people have gambled with the money. Some people bought lottery tickets. Some people bought drugs. You know, so there's a whole range of purchases.
I guess the question is, can the tattoo industry keep America afloat? The question for you is, because this is really kind of an X-ray, an MRI, really, of how the economy works. So you got your stimulus check. You spent it to produce this website, howispentmystimulus.com. Have you made any money?
No, I have not made any money.
So the stimulus kind of stops right there. It's sort of a dead end, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. Ouch. I mean, we're actually shopping for a book publisher this week, so who knows? But my intention was not really to make any money. I just wanted to find an innovative way to sort of capture these stories. And it's been a really interesting study in how Americans spend their money during a rough economic period.
What inspired you to collect all of these stories? Obviously not a scientific poll by any measure, but a really knitting together of how people are reacting. Where did the idea come from?
You know, just sort of randomly. I mean, there was so much speculation on where the money was going. Was it actually going to create this shopping spree to boost the economy? And I just figured that we should try to figure out how people are spending this money. Simple as that.
Rudy, you're in Phoenix, Arizona. What's your day job?
Actually, I live in Brooklyn.
Oh,
but,
you do?
I'm here visiting family. I am a...
You're in Phoenix, though, so I got that part right.
I am in Phoenix right now.
Brooklyn is really near Phoenix.
I am a freelance writer and entrepreneur.
Well, that's great. Rudy, you know, this is great that you've... It's great to see people's stories of how they spent their money. And, you know, often economic indicators, even if they're anecdotal, are pretty fascinating. So thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Rudy Adler of howispentmystimulus.com. And just to clear up some business from over the week, we asked you for some reviews of movies, and we wanted you to go to films and leave your reviews at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we had some reviewers take a look at Kung Fu Panda and You Don't Mess with the Zohan. Kung Fu Panda, of course, did $60 million box office. Zohan, the Adam Sandler film, did $40 million. Here are some reviews, and the premise was this. We didn't ask you to review the film just for anybody, but review it for those poor candidates who, over the last 5 months, haven't had a chance to see any sort of movies. And here are some reviews.
Hi, this is Nell Minow, the movie mom from BeliefNet, with some recommendations for the candidates. They should all go to see Iron Man. Why? For one thing, it's about accountability, and it's about sometimes the people that are closest to you are not necessarily trustworthy. Very important lessons for them to learn. And they should all go see Kung Fu Panda, too. They'll learn about the resilience that it takes to win and the importance of being honest.
I'm Dan Leiberger from eFilmCritic.com. Senator Clinton should catch Kung Fu Panda even though Chelsea's no longer in its age bracket. Her progress from First Lady to serious presidential contender is oddly reflected in the film. Even the harshest odds can be defeated with the right support and circumstances. What seems like a defeat at one point of a journey can be a victory in a longer quest.
And that's the second metaphor for Hillary Clinton in this program. Dan Zirin, of course, was saying, or David Zirin was saying, that Kobe Bryant is the Hillary Clinton of the NBA. The movie Don't Mess with the Zohan produced more passionate and, shall we say, darker responses. Here's one of those reviews.
This is Frank Ulching for MovieEye.com. Cheer up, all you ex-presidential challengers out there. For self-esteem purposes, you might consider checking out the noxious one-note Adam Sandler comedy, You Don't Mess with the Zohan, as a reminder of how it would have been so convenient if your opponent wasn't as sharp as a paper knife. Had Zohan been your political rival, you could have beaten him soundly.
Adam Sandler, noxious? Ooh, here's
Boy,
another.
They don't give anybody a break, do they? They're pretty tough.
Here's even tougher. Listen.
My name is Jim Kerr. I'm calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. I just heard the trailer for the new Adam Sandler film, and I don't know if I'm going to see it because I feel that the three most frightening words in film have always been starring Adam Sandler.
I thought it was starring Pauly Shore.
But our guest, the Israeli former commando or military man who is now a stylist in New York City.
Yep. Right.
He liked the movie.
He thought
it was funny, and he thought that there were some strong messages in it.
He thought it was his life.
His life.
He thought it was great kung fu, and he thought that it made a plea for peace between the Arabs and the Israelis, all in an Adam Sandler movie, which is quite a lot.
I don't think these reviewers, I don't think they believe that.
Well, you know, but it doesn't matter what we think. We want your reviews. 877-8-MY-TAKE is, you know, the word of mouth that we want you to deliver to us at our website, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And we have still a lot of responses from people telling us where they spent their stimulus check, including a bunch of people correcting me for in the last hour mentioning that the only way you don't get a stimulus check is if your income is too high. Actually, if your income is too low, you don't get a stimulus check. There are delays in sending them out. So if you haven't received one yet, it may be the case that you're still going to, that the time isn't out yet.
Yeah, because I started with the internet. There was automatic, I'm sorry, not the internet. They had automatic deposit, and then they're sending them out in the mail. That would be the IRS. And there are all kinds of qualifications. So if you're not sure exactly where you fit in getting a stimulus check, you should check out the IRS.gov website, and they lay out all the rules for who's getting what and when they should be getting it.
And that's linked from our site. Robin says, you ask how I spent my stimulus check? I didn't. I put it in my savings account. And my check has been – Douglas says that this is tough. Douglas says, my check has been appropriated as an installment on taxes. The IRS says I owe them, and I say I don't. So they've garnished my check. Poof. Poor Doug.
Poof. Douglas Gordon said, hey, my partner and I, we both got stimulus checks, and we both used our checks to go on vacation in Peru. Not one penny was spent to stimulate the U.S. economy, but instead we gave our money to Peru's economy.
Peru.
I bet you they had a good time.
Peru. Let's hope they had a good time, and they stimulated the Peruvian economy. Stimulate us, won't you, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can hear our show on iTunes, podcast. Respond to anything you hear on the show at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And you can see our movie mashup on our website. Plus, as John said, we're on the YouTube, iTunes, and Facebook. So join in the discussion any way you'd like to.
And if you're having a bad hair day, go see Oded Gabe at the Lavella Hair Salon right here in New York City.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.